can recover his gear from the mist shark.
Bridget nodded.
And Raoul? I remember he had a cut on his head.
Gwen glanced up toward a set of cabinets on one wall and flipped her bandaged hand toward them. Bridget followed the direction of the gesture and spotted the ginger cat asleep on top of a cabinet. One side of his head was wrapped in a clean white bandage.
He's quite the hero at the moment. The men say he saved their lives.
Well, yes, Bridget said, though I almost feel that they shouldn't go about saying it aloud. He's already impossible to deal with.
Just then the world lurched sideways. Bridget all but fell off the stool. For a second she thought her head injury had caused her to lose her balance, but then she realized that several of the pallets on the floor of the infirmary had slid half a foot across the floor before being brought to a halt by tethers attached to odd rings in the walls.
"What was that?"
she asked.
"Crosswind. We're underway, in pursuit of the mist shark,"
Gwen replied.
"We have been for nearly 2 hours."
"Underway? On an airship?"
"Then there was nothing around them. Nothing at all. No walls, no spire, no ground. Just the vast and empty reaches of the sky."
Bridget's heart labored quicker, and the aches in her head and leg increased. Raoul hurt, Benedict dying, terrible, irrational fear knotting her guts, blood on her hands.
That was enough for one day, she supposed.
She bowed her head and began shuddering with silent tears.
"Oh,"
Gwen said. Bridget could sense her make a few abortive motions before she patted Bridget on the shoulder and said awkwardly,
"There, there. It's all right. All's not lost yet. Captain Grimm is quite confident we can bring the mist shark to battle."
"Yes, of course,"
Bridget said, nodding.
"But if it's all the same to you, I'm going to take a few moments to cry, in any case."
Gwen was silent for a while. Then there was the sound of ripping fabric, and she pressed a length of somewhat stained cloth torn from her too large shirt into Bridget's hand. The small gesture of kindness broke something. Bridget leaned toward Gwen, sobbing. Gwen grunted a bit with the effort, but braced herself and held the larger girl steady with an arm around her. Bridget leaned against her and wept so hard that stars spun across the insides of her eyelids. But she did not make noise doing it. She simply couldn't. She didn't give herself long. 5 minutes, perhaps, passed before Bridget forced herself to steady her breathing. She sat up slowly and wiped her face with the cloth, then blew her nose. She nodded to Gwen and said,
"Thank you.
You are welcome."
The heir of the most powerful family in Spire Albion regarded Bridget soberly.
"I'm not a very good friend," Gwen said. "I'm willful and blunt and arrogant, and I've not had a great deal of practice. Frankly, I've never been good at stomaching the company of the other children of the great houses."
Bridget let out a short, subdued laugh.
"Neither have I."
"Well then," Gwen said,
"common ground."
Just then, outside the infirmary, a bell began to ring. Bridget looked at Gwen in question, but the other girl shook her head. She didn't know what the sound signified either.
"General quarters, lads," Dr. Bagan called. The room stirred with sudden activity. The men, assisting him, immediately began belting the wounded man down to the examination table with straps apparently made for the purpose. After that, they methodically, quickly did the same to the men on the pallets, while Bagan himself began clipping leather straps attached to a wide leather belt to rings set in the examination table. Another pair of aeronauts began putting jars and bottles and other supplies away in close-fitting storage cabinets, apparently determined to leave nothing sitting loose around the compartment.
"Here,"
Gwen said. She reached down and produced a similar wide leather belt and began passing it around Bridget's middle.
If you don't strap up and the ship is forced to manoeuvre quickly, you could be thrown into the wall or the ceiling with enough force to kill you.
Bridget let Gwen secure the thick belt on her. Then Gwen showed her how to clip the straps to rings set into the walls and floor all about the compartment, evidently for this very purpose, and how to cinch the lines in tight.
Bridget felt a bit like a vegetable hung up to dry by the time the process was over, but she could see the need for it. And then a terrible thought struck her.
"Gwen," she said, "what about Raoul?"
Gwen blinked and then turned to Dr. Bacon, who had resumed work on Mr. Stern.
"Sir, what about the cat? Is there a belt for him?"
"No," Bacon said, without looking up. "Nothing that small."
He finished tying a knot in a length of suturing thread and looked up, frowning.
"But we can't have the little blighter flying about my infirmary, can we?"
The rhythm of the ringing bell changed, and Bacon cursed.
"Manoeuvres! Get hold of him quick!"
"Raoul!"
Bridget called, opening her arms. Raoul rose up, his movement slower and less fluid than it normally was, and leapt toward her. Predator lurched, and a weight like a loaded tank from her father's battery pressed her mercilessly to the deck.
Chapter 65. DMS Mist Shark.
Major Respira looked around the hold of the Mist Shark at his command. His marines had performed with most excellent discipline. Their losses had been serious, but not utterly outrageous, and if they had not accomplished absolutely every objective on their mission, their main objectives had been achieved. The presence of his force had inflicted a paralytic fear on the citizens of Spire Albion. The landing shipyard had been destroyed, and it would take months, if not years, to rebuild after the internal economic chaos bound to ensue in Spire Albion. Cavendish had recovered her book, though Espira had not been made privy to its significance, and every duplicate copy of the volume had been destroyed with the monastery. He had led his men on a mission of extraordinary ambition and extraordinary danger. More important, thank God in heaven, Espira had also led most of them out again. His losses had been lighter than he'd dared to hope for. Of course, he'd paid a price to do it. He'd led an attack on a temple of the Way and its resident monks. He'd set fire to a habal full of civilians. Enemies, true, but civilians nonetheless. If he hadn't, there was no way his men would have made it out with such light losses. He had traded the lives of people he did not know for those of men he did. That was, he supposed, human nature. He was proud of his men. He was proud of what they had accomplished, how hard they had trained, and how that training had paid off. He was proud of the blow they'd dealt to the Albion menace. He was proud that he'd taken command of them, knowing that he had a better chance to bring more Marines home alive than any other commanding officer available for the mission. But he was not proud of the things he'd had to do to get them home again. And, he reminded himself grimly, they weren't home yet. The weary men were stacked fairly closely in the airship's hold. Most of his Marines, being good soldiers, were already asleep. Some were still too wound up from the action and were speaking quietly together. Some of the wounded lay quietly suffering as they waited their turn with Mist Shark's doctor. A quartet of seasoned veterans had simply broken out a deck of cards and begun playing, despite the dimness of the hold. The mood wasn't as joyous as it could have been. Men had been wounded. Men had fallen. The elation that each man felt in having survived the mission was tempered by the knowledge that others like him had not been so fortunate. No, not joy, but definitely relief. Relief that it was over. Relief that the Reaper had not chosen them today. Relief that they were going home. Though, he reminded himself again, they weren't home yet. but they had a good running start toward getting there. Siriaco approached through the gloom. A tall sergeant ducked under the beams that supported the airship's deck above them, nodded to Espira, saluted, and said,
"She wants to see you in her cabin, sir."
"Of course she does," Espira said. He sighed and pushed himself up from his comfortable bed of lumpy cloth sacks. "Time enough for sleep when I'm dead, I suppose." Siriaco made a grimacing expression that passed for a pained smile.
"You want me to come with you?"
"No, Sergeant. I expect that if she was going to snap, she'd have done it before now. I'll be fine." Siriaco frowned but nodded.
"I'll ride herd on the boys for you, sir."
"Make sure everyone's strapped in and battened down, then get some sleep. I'm sure it won't take long,"
Espira replied. He started climbing the steep staircase to the deck and hoped that he knew what he was talking about. The Mist Shark was not a ship of the Armada. The heavily tarred planking and decks looked smudged and dirty, though he imagined it provided excellent protection from the elements. And of course it made the ship less visible in low-lighting conditions, which was doubtless useful to a captain who was up to no good. That said, however, the ship was run with all the professionalism of a vessel of the Armada, even if the crew looked like a pack of cutthroats and scoundrels. Certainly the Mist Shark's gunnery had been excellent, efficiently destroying the landing shipyard. Granted, any target that could not shoot back was hardly a challenge, much less one a bare 100 yards away, but not a single blast had gone to waste, and the Mist Shark had managed to destroy some 30 times her own weight in enemy merchant craft, as well as millions of crowns of priceless Albion infrastructure. The men around him were a crew of evil-eyed, pitiless apes, but they had done good service to Spire Aurora. He did not need to like them to respect their ability. Espira reached the door to Madame Cavendish's cabin and raised his hand to knock.
"Come in, Major,"
she called, before his knuckles had touched the door. Espira suppressed a shiver and entered the cabin. Cavendish sat inside at a small tea-table, calmly, primly, her gown's bodice unfastened and hanging down to her waist. She was clad in only a thin shift from the waist up. Mist Shark's doctor, a wiry piker covered in outlandish tattoos, was tying off a bandage that had been wound round and round Madame Cavendish's ribs. Her position left an unseemly amount of skin on display, and Espira forced himself not to look at the smooth strength of the woman's shoulders or the clean, graceful line of her neck. It would not do to permit himself to think of Cavendish as a woman. She was a monster. She still held the slender volume in one hand, and was reading with unnervingly steady attention, even as the doctor ministered to her. There was a bunk bed in the room. The lower berth had clearly been reserved for Cavendish, but the top was occupied by the bags of miscellaneous objects she had insisted upon bringing aboard. It took Espira a moment to notice that Sark was in the room. The bandaged, wounded warrior-born wasn't on one of the bunks. Instead, he lay under Madame Cavendish's bunk, like some hideous spider lurking beneath an imperfect bit of decorative moulding. Espira could see for a second the glitter of gold-green light reflecting from warrior-born eyes, and then it was gone.
"Major,"
Cavendish said, smiling faintly,
"the good doctor is nearly finished ministering to me. Do sit down."
Espira doffed his hat and bowed politely before seating himself in the room's only other chair across the small table from Cavendish.
"How can I be of service, madame?"
"I need your professional assessment,"
she replied.
"How quickly could your men seize this ship?"
For a second, the doctor's hands froze in place. Espira frowned,
staring at Cavendish, looking for some clue in her features as to how she expected him to answer. Judging from her expression, Cavendish had noticed the doctor's reaction too. Her mouth quirked up at one corner.
Hypothetically speaking, of course.
Ah. She wanted the man to hear what he had to say.
The crew is outnumbered and outgunned, Ispira replied slowly. And my men are the best. On the other hand, we don't know what measures the crew has put in place to even the odds in such an action. But I am confident to say that my men could take this ship 8 or 9 times in 10.
That is excellent news, Cavendish said. Doctor, have you finished?
Aye, up, the doctor muttered to Cavendish. The man never looked at her face. It should heal up fine.
Can't see as the ball tore any bone off the ribs, so no splinters. Clean it twice a day, fresh bandages each time, and don't go jumping about.
You'll tend to it, Doctor,
Cavendish replied.
I will see you after breakfast and after dinner. Plan accordingly.
The man clearly resented the command, but he only touched his fingers to the brim of a hat he was not wearing, and hurried out of the cabin. Ispira waited for the man to go before turning to Cavendish and asking, "Why?"
"Our pace is too slow,"
Cavendish replied as she carefully slipped back into her gown.
"If that does not change, we may not reach our escort before Albion's fleet catches up to us. I notified Captain Ransom of this fact several times and have received no reply. I do not care to be ignored. Tea?"
"Yes, thank you," Ispira said.
Cavendish rose smoothly, turned her back on the Major and stopped. It dawned on him after a moment that she was waiting on him, and Ispira rose immediately. "Madame?"
"Button me up, if you would, Major."
"It would be my pleasure," Ispira said, stepping forward.
"It had best not be,"
Cavendish said, in a poisonously sweet tone. Ispira felt his spine go rigid. He forced himself to inhale and exhale deeply. Then he went about fastening up a score of buttons on the back of Cavendish's gown with quick, efficient motions. A few moments later they both sat back down at the table for the tea Madame Cavendish prepared. As she poured, the dismal grey light of the mists outside shifted and grew brighter. The grey of the mezzosphere gave way to the cerulean blue of the aerosphere as the ship emerged into open sky. A moment after that, the door opened abruptly, and Calliope Ransom strode into the cabin. Mist Shark's lean captain had a vulpine air about her, and her green eyes flickered with raw anger. Her dark aeronaut's leathers were worn and of excellent quality, as were the blade at her side, the gauntlet on her hand, and a trio of pistols slung one after another on her belt.
"Good morning, Captain,"
Cavendish said in a pleasant tone.
"Will you join us for tea?"
"No, thank you."
Ransom stared hard at Ispira for a moment, her eyes calculating. Then she nodded a few times and said,
"This is my ship, and while you are valued customers, you are guests on my vessel, and by God in heaven you will comport yourselves as such."
"Or what follows?"
Cavendish asked in a gentle tone.
"You leave the ship," Captain Ransom said simply.
"Do you mean to force me over the rail, Captain?"
"No need," Ransom replied. "Santos has already opened the cargo doors in the hold below this cabin, including the one on the exterior ventral hull."
She tapped a toe on the wooden deck.
"Beneath this deck there is nothing but sky, and the explosive charges that will shatter this floor and send everything in the cabin tumbling down into the mist, along with you, your creepy attaché, and this sorry son of a bitch from Aurora."
Cavendish tilted her head sharply.
Excuse me?
If I don't come out of this cabin within the next 10 minutes, Santos sets off the charges. If I emerge from this cabin acting odd or out of character, he sets off the charges. If he so much as gets a bad feeling that you're up to something, he has orders to set off the charges and kill you all.
Silence grew in the room. Espira cleared his throat.
I believe you are bluffing, Captain Ransom.
The captain's sharp smile grew sharper.
Am I? I wonder.
Cavendish mused aloud.
If you are truly the kind of person who would rig her guest quarters to murder her guests, should they become inconvenient?
Captain Ransom cocked an eyebrow.
I wonder if you are the sort of person who would make an extremely foolish threat simply to get her extremely busy host's attention.
Touché,
Cavendish murmured.
Could you not have taken a moment to speak to me? It does seem polite.
Polite is lovely for tea parties, Ransom replied. It is of limited value when one is attempting to outrun the fastest and best-trained airship fleet the world has ever known. She looked at each of them. A fact you should consider when calculating whether or not you should attempt to take my ship. You might take her, but you won't take her whole, and all of Albion will be on your heels in hours, if they are not there already.
Meaning? Espira asked.
Meaning that your marines aren't aeronauts. They can't sail like aeronauts, they can't think like aeronauts, and they can't manage the ship as well as aeronauts. And that goes double for whoever you put in charge of them. If you kill me and take my ship, you're never going to get back to Spire Aurora alive. The Albions will catch you and kill you. It's as simple as that.
Cavendish's mouth spread into a wide smile, one that looked eerily out of place on her features.
"I believe I can respect you, Captain," she said.
She stared at Ransom with the smile fixed in place, took a slow sip of tea, and then said,
"The ship has slowed."
Ransom's brow furrowed. She kept her features composed, but Espira had the impression that she was nearly as unnerved by Cavendish as he was.
"How could you possibly know that?"
"Am I right?"
"You are," Ransom said.
"Why?"
"Corrosion in the Haslet cage, my engineer says," the captain replied.
She cast an aggravated glance toward the stern of the ship.
"It's causing irregular power flow. We had to back off on the throttle or risk blowing out runs and relays."
"Can it be corrected?"
Cavendish asked.
"Not without taking the core offline to scour the Haslet cage," Ransom said. "We would be forced to rely on wind-powered sails until the cage could be cleaned and reassembled. We can run at 85%, or we can stop using the web entirely and trust in the wind."
"And why do we not do that?"
Espira managed to keep from wincing. Cavendish might be fiendishly clever and dangerous, but the question betrayed a vast ignorance of aeronautics. Ransom managed to answer as though the question had not sounded like one coming from a curious child.
"Wind-powered sails are efficient, since they cost no energy consumption from the power core, but they lack the maneuverability offered by an etheric web," she said. "A ship running under wind-powered sails makes its best speed amongst only a limited arc of possible directions, and can be easily outmaneuvered by a powered ship. And if you don't have a good strong wind, a web-driven ship will outrun a wind-powered ship."
"You're saying that relying upon the sails creates too many variables,"
Cavendish said thoughtfully.
"I'm saying that it dispenses with too many options," Ransom replied. "If we disassemble the Haslet cage, all we have are the sails. No web, no shroud, no weapons. If the fleet sighted us, we could do nothing but run, and if the wind was not favorable, we would be rapidly destroyed. Once we reach the rendezvous, we can repair the cage."
"Why then?"
because we'll have an escort to screen for us should a fleet ship find us," she said. "We'll be able to sail down into the mist while the escort engages the enemy."
She arched an eyebrow.
"This little lesson in aeronautics has cost this ship in terms of efficiency, because I was here answering your questions instead of doing everything I possibly could to keep us all alive. Enjoy your tea, madame. If I can avoid any further interruptions, this should be over soon."
Cavendish set the teacup and saucer down carefully.
"I'm not sure I like your tone, Captain."
Captain Ransom put her right fist on her hip.
"This is my ship, madame," she said. "Consequently, I'm the one who makes decisions about tone here. Do us all a favour. Drink your tea like a good trog and stop interfering with professionals."
Cavendish's eyes flashed with a spark of heat, echoed by the kindling of what looked like a tiny star in the crimson crystal at her throat. Espera grimaced. He put down his teacup and shifted his weight slightly in his seat, so that he could throw himself rapidly to the floor should violence erupt.
"You are ill-mannered, Captain," Madame Cavendish said.
Ransom smirked.
"Feel free to leave my ship whenever you wish, you arrogant bit."
And just then a bell began to ring at frantic pace.
"General quarters!" boomed the enormous executive officer's voice out on the ship's deck.
Ransom spat a foul curse and flung herself at the cabin's door. Just as she opened it, there was a howl of discharges from a broadside of etheric cannon, an enormous flash of light, and a sound like thousands of dry bones snapping.
"Strap in!"
Espera shouted to Cavendish, even as he rose and rushed after Captain Ransom. He dashed out onto the deck in time to see Mist Shark's entire starboard etheric web shot away from the ship. It was on fire, adrift and falling with lazy grace back toward the mist of the mesosphere. The ship lurched, its drag suddenly unbalanced, its stern slewing to port as its bow rotated in the direction of the missing web. There was a rushing sound, and scarcely 500 yards away, a lean, sleek airship flying Albion's scarlet, azure, and white colours sailed up into view from beneath the mist shark, with seemingly effortless speed and grace. The name on the prow declared her the AMS Predator. Espera clenched his teeth. Skippers in the Auroran Armada and merchant fleet alike spoke of the privateer's ship in hushed, angry tones. Predator had been single-handedly responsible for nearly a quarter of Spire Aurora's merchant losses in the 2 years leading up to this war. Before he could finish the thought, Predator's guns howled again, this time firing overhead, snipping off Mist Shark's dorsal web as neatly as a seamstress with her shears. This time the web came slithering down onto the ship, burning, sparks flying off it with miniature lightning snaps of discharging static electricity whenever it touched non-wooden material, such as the Mist Shark's crew. Espera looked up and saw burning web falling directly toward him. He seized Captain Ransom by the belt and pulled her back into the doorway of the cabin an instant before the web reached her. It struck the metal doorknob instead, sparking a bright flash of light that left a scorch mark on the metal. Even as the web settled, Mist Shark became further unbalanced, her nose rising. Espera automatically snapped a pair of safety lines onto a pair of nearby hooks, in time to use their support to keep from being rocked off his feet from the ship's wallowing.
"Damn it! How?"
Captain Ransom snarled as the web piled down atop her ship, hundreds of feet long, and a nearly equal amount across. The deck was rapidly beginning to look like the inside of a silkweaver nest. She snapped her goggles down over her eyes.
"Santos!" she bellowed. "Signal rockets now! Keep them going!"
"Aye!"
boomed the executive officer. A second later there was a rushing sound, and a comet trailing a blazing tail of fire lifted into the sky.
"Firefighting party to the deck!" she shouted.
"Aye, skipper!"
"Guns! Fire at will!"
Seconds later, 10 etheric cannon opened fire on Predator. But the lean ship had already altered its course and abruptly dropped lower, evading the broadside and plunging back into the mists below. Just before it did, there was a rushing sound, and rockets raced out from Predator, exploding 1,000 yards overhead into a thick, dense cloud of yellow smoke. Ransom stared after the vanishing ship, her eyes narrowed in thought. Then she nodded and shouted,
"Pilot, course change. 20 degrees west.
20 degrees west, aye.
Full speed ahead. Everything you've got."
A second pair of mist sharks' blazing signal rockets raced up into the blue sky.
"Aye, skipper."
The ship groaned as it banked and accelerated, wobbling like a drunkard. A wooden keg that had not been properly secured bounced across the steeply angled deck and tumbled over the side of the ship into the abyss below.
"Is this wise, Captain?"
Espira asked quietly.
"No,"
Ransom replied bluntly.
"Goggles."
Espira nodded and secured his eye protection, while Ransom drew her blade and began hacking at the ether silk webbing blocking her passage to the deck.
"We can't force him to fight with half our web shot away," she said. "We're too slow on our feet now. If we try it, he'll outmaneuver us and take out the rest of our web within minutes, or work the angles to position himself at weak points in our fields of fire and hammer through our shroud. His ship is lighter and faster, so we can't outdive him or escape into the mist, lamed as we are. Our only chance is to get to our escort before Captain Grimm turns us into a barge."
Espira drew his sword and began hacking away at the ether silk as soon as Ransom had progressed enough to give him room to swing it. She glanced at him and nodded silent approval.
"Captain Grimm," Espira said, "there are a lot of people in Aurora who are coming to despise the man."
Ransom bared her teeth, her eyes glittering as another pair of her ship's rockets raced out above and behind them.
"And to think, they weren't even married to him."
Chapter 66 AMS Predator. "Excellent shooting, Mr. Creedy," Grimm called out to the portside gun crews. The shots hadn't been difficult given the total surprise they'd attained on Mist Shark, but fully half of Calliope's web had been shot away, and at this point victory was only a matter of proper doctrine and intelligent manoeuvre. "Mr. Kettle, stabilize us, if you please."
Kettle nodded, already trimming the ship, bringing her level again after their dive into the mist to evade Mist Shark's hurried reply.
"About there should do it, Skip,"
Kettle said.
Grimm nodded and turned to the gun crews. "XO," he called, "transfer the crews to the starboard battery." "You heard him, boys," Creedy called. "Secure your guns, unhook, and get to the other side."
Predator's aeronauts leapt to obey, locking down the portside guns again and crossing the ship to the bank of weapons on the opposite side. Grimm clenched his jaw. Casualties among his crew had been severe. He had only enough crews to man one bank of guns. But there was no sense in letting Calliope know that. Should she work out that he could project force from only one side of Predator at a time, she could complicate matters enormously.
"Captain," called an aeronaut from the deck behind him and below.
Grimm turned to find Mr. Eubanks, a stout, florid veteran with a bristling beard, waiting for him.
"Report. We just fired the last of the signal rockets, Skip." "Very good. You and your crew stand by for damage control."
"Damage control, aye,"
Eubanks said, and hurried back down the deck again.
"She's banking, Skip,"
Kettle noted, peering up at the red star still suspended in Predator's shroud. It had begun to track more sharply to the west. Calliope was hoping to open some distance between her ship and Predator, while Grimm was temporarily blinded by the mists.
"Adjust course, Mr. Kettle," Grimm said.
Kettle grunted and did so, as Predator maneuvered to ascend from the mist beneath Mist Shark, this time on her other flank, and finish the job of laming her. Calliope had no way of knowing that Predator could see her.
"Something wrong, Skip?"
Grim shook his head once.
"No, but it hardly seems fair, does it?" "No, it does not, Skipper. It certainly does not."
Kettle's face split into an evil grin.
"Ain't it grand? Where can we get us one of those etherealists?
Let us survive the day first and consider such matters later," Grim said. "Once we're in position, we'll use the same approach as last time. But once we've fired, we'll accelerate our ascension to get above their guns' elevation instead of diving under them."
"That wasn't hardly a dive,"
Kettle pointed out.
"We don't dare try any more than that," Grim said. "Journeyman says the power runs are barely holding together as it is. If we put the strain of a full dive on the ship, we could lose them entirely."
It would, Grim thought, be a horrible surprise to find out mid-dive that your ship had suddenly lost the ability to stop diving.
"Attack run and evasive ascension on your order, aye," Kettle said.
There was a sharp whistle. The pilot turned his head toward the starboard gunnery deck and nodded.
"Exo reports guns are ready to fire, Skip."
"Very good," Grim said.
"Stand by." "You think Mist Shark will surrender once we've lamed her?" Kettle asked. "She's got a good many fighting men on board."
A pulse of hot anger touched Grim's chest.
"They will surrender, Mr. Kettle," he said crisply. "Or so help me God in heaven, I will scatter that ship across continents."
Kettle glanced aside at him, and Grim saw the pilot shift his feet uneasily. Kettle lowered his voice, and his tone was cautious, concerned.
"Don't get me wrong, Captain. After what Mist Shark did to that shipyard, I'm more ready than ever to blow her clean out of the aerosphere. But would you really do that?"
"To Calliope," Kettle's tone said, though he did not finish the sentence aloud. Grim felt something twist and writhe inside him, a half-hysterical laugh that threatened to escape his lips. He hammered it down ruthlessly.
"Only if she gives me no other choice."
He tried to offer Kettle a reassuring glance. "She is who she is. Do you really think she's become a loyal soldier to the cause of Spire Aurora?" Kettle snorted.
"Point. She'll yield, unless the Aurorans don't let her."
"We are at war,"
Grim said quietly.
"I will do what I must."
Grim closed his eyes for a moment and took a slow breath, trying to get a sense of the ship around him. He gauged the wind, felt the slight tilt in her deck of the weight of half her crew overloading the starboard side. He felt the quivering hum of her core crystal, a barely perceptible buzz through the soles of his boots. It was, of course, a romantic fancy that he almost felt he could hear the same subtle hum of power coming from the capacitors of the cannon on the starboard gun deck. But nonetheless, his instincts confirmed what his intellect had already told him to be true. Predator was ready.
"Sound maneuvers," Grim called,
and the aeronaut manning the ship's bell began beating out the proper rhythm to warn the crew to secure themselves.
"Stand by, gunners."
"Gunners ready, Captain,"
Creedy called. Grim double-checked his safety lines and snugged them tight.
"Mr. Kettle,"
he said,
"commence attack."
Predator shot up through the misty mezzosphere with the effortless grace of a cloud fin and the speed of a signal rocket. The acceleration in the ascension, driven by the enormous power of the new lift crystal, was at least as great as that the ship experienced in a dive. Grim had to keep a firm grip on the railing of the bridge, or risk being driven to his knees as the ship began to quiver and rattle, and then she began to sing. Grim knew that he should be presenting a stoic, solid, unmoving example to his men, become a graven image of steadfast discipline and determination, but he simply could not remain still. He could feel Predator's grace, the light and easy way she moved through the air, could feel the fierce, proud joy that filled her as she rushed into battle, all of which was ridiculous on a purely rational level. Grim knew that with his head. His heart knew better. As Predator's war song swept up in pitch and volume, a crewman erupted into a howling cry of his own. Grim realized with something of a start that the scream was coming from his own throat. The bellow from the crew, a beat later, was the loudest Grim had ever heard, despite their depleted numbers, and he could hear Creedy shouting with the rest of them. The grey mist abruptly lightened, turning paler grey, then pearly, then white, and a breath later, Predator exploded out of the mesosphere and into the wide blue sky. Mr. Kettle had timed his approach perfectly. They emerged from the cloud cover, almost directly beneath the mist shark, travelling at almost exactly the same speed, only a few hundred yards out. In their first attack run, surprise had been on Predator's side. Now speed was everything. "Fire at will!" Grim shouted.
"Fire! Fire! Fire!"
Creedy cried, relaying the command to the gun crews. Predator's 7 cannon fired almost simultaneously. Even though his men had instructions to fire only at the enemy's web, from their angle beneath the mist shark, there was no way to absolutely guarantee that the blasts would miss the ship itself, but his crews performed well. The ventral web burst into flame and began drooping and falling as multiple blasts struck it. A pair of stray shots went past the web and crashed against the mist shark's active shroud, and were harmlessly absorbed as a sudden sphere of greenish light surrounded the airship. Grim could all but feel the shock and dismay of the enemy crew. He did not blame them. For an airship to pursue a wounded foe with such perfect precision from within the misty veil of the mesosphere was a feat so improbable as to approach impossibility. But more vitally, he knew that even now the mist shark's gunners would be frantically depressing the snouts of their weapons to fire down at Predator the instant their pilot rocked the ship enough to give them a clean shot. Grim waited until he saw the enemy ship begin to roll to present her broadside to Predator, and then called, "Ascend!" Mr. Kettle threw the ship into her new maximum amount of climb, and Grim staggered and nearly fell despite his grip on the handrail. Predator sailed as swiftly and cleanly as a worthy soul winging to its eternal reward. 8 of the enemy cannon rent the air Predator had just departed with their fury, and the single blast that did manage to strike home brought forth only the incandescent green gleam of Predator's own protective shroud. Grim had timed their maneuver successfully. The mist shark's gunners tried to track Predator as she rose, but reached the limit of their elevation short of catching up to the lighter, faster ship. In order to track back onto Predator, the mist shark's pilot would have to rock the ship back up to level and onto her other side, all while being dragged forward, listing and pitching, by the uneven pull of a single quarter of her web. Shifting that much awkward mass against its own momentum and inertia would require crucial seconds. Seconds Grim had no intention of giving away.
"Fire!" he called.
Again, the gunners did their job. A single stray blast slipped through the web and flashed against the enemy's shroud, but the other half-dozen raked through the mist shark's last remaining length of web, tearing it from the ship and setting it ablaze. Mist shark's acceleration immediately dropped to nothing, her drunken, wallowing form now gliding forward on nothing but waning momentum. Desperate signal rockets again flashed away from her, and Grim saw the enemy ship struggling to stabilize itself with its trim crystals alone. A tricky proposition without enough forward motion to allow the more responsive maneuvering planes to assist with the task, and until it was completed, the mist shark was virtually helpless against Predator's mobility. As long as Kettle could keep their ship out of the firing arcs of Mist Shark's cannon, predator could pour fire down upon the enemy without reservation or fear of reply. And Mr. Kettle knew his business as well as any man alive. Kettle guided Predator into a high arc, rolling the ship onto her starboard side to present their broadside to the enemy, slowing just enough to give the gun crews the cleanest shot possible. Grimm felt his stomach twist, and he tried to swallow through a dry throat. He was about to find out whether or not his duty would require him to murder Calliope and her crew. He flipped down the telescopic on his goggles and focused his attention intently on the mist shark.
"By the numbers," Grimm shouted. "Fire!"
"Gun two!"
Creedy bellowed.
"Fire!"
The frontmost cannon of the starboard side of the ship howled, its blast smashing into Mist Shark's straining shroud.
"Gun four!" Creedy called. "Fire!"
The second starboard gun unleashed its fury, hammering down at the enemy's shroud, hungry for the vulnerable, unarmored airship beneath.
"Gun six! Fire!"
The Mist Shark's shroud's bright illumination grew dimmer, more translucent.
"Gun eight! Fire!"
The blast scorched the topmost mast of the enemy ship, and Grimm saw what he had been looking for. A tall, lean figure, Calliope herself, he supposed, rushed the aft dorsal mast and smacked a boarding axe down onto one of the lines running up it. The line parted, and the Mist Shark's Delosian colours, a white star upon a bisected red and blue field, went fluttering down toward the ship's deck in the aeronaut's universal signal of surrender.
"Cease fire!" Grimm roared. "Cease fire!"
"Cease fire!"
Creedy echoed to the crews. And the reverberating thunderous howl of the last shot from the number eight gun faded and vanished into the open blue. The Mist Shark lay quietly, meekly, beneath them, as Kettle brought Predator around, keeping the enemy covered with her starboard cannon. Grimm let Creedy and Kettle handle the maneuvering, while he watched the enemy's gunners. They were, in proper form, retracting their cannon back into their secure position, where they would be unable to fire. It would appear that their surrender was genuine, though it was Calliope, after all. Grimm would proceed by the numbers, without dropping his guard. He felt a fierce smile stretch his lips.
"Mr. Creedy," he called, "fire up the launch, if you please. Signal to Captain Ransom my compliments. Surrender and prepare to be boarded."
The cheer that rose up from his aeronauts made the planking beneath Grimm's feet vibrate, and he fancied that Predator was voicing her triumph along with the men who crewed her. Within a quarter of an hour, Calliope crossed to Predator on her launch, its steam engine chugging the little craft steadily over from the Mist Shark. She had two crewmen with her to manage the launch, in addition to both of Master Ferris's missing wagons and a slender volume matching the one in Grimm's coat pocket, stolen from the Great Library. If Calliope had just been soundly defeated by a smaller, less heavily armed vessel, it did not show in her swagger or her confident expression. If she was intimidated by the dozen or so primed gauntlets being aimed at her, it could not be seen from the outside. She stepped up to the bow of the launch as it docked with Predator, with her usual smirk on her lips.
"Permission to come aboard, Francis."
Grimm reminded himself that she was calling him by that name only because she knew it annoyed him, and that he should not surrender to manipulation.
"Granted," he called calmly.
Calliope hopped down onto Predator's deck and peered around the ship curiously as she paced to the bridge and ascended the steps to it.
"Well, well, well," she said. "That was a bit of a surprise. What on earth have you been feeding her?"
"Enemies."
Calliope threw her head back and laughed.
"Book, please," Grimm said.
She tossed him the volume amiably, and he caught it.
"You've no idea the foul looks I collected when I went to get it."
Did the Aurorans give you any trouble about striking your colours?
Nothing I couldn't handle, she said breezily. I must admit, Francis, you do gorgeous work. That was excellently done, though you'd never have beaten me in a fair fight.
I avoid them, Grim replied. So do you.
Her teeth flashed very white, and she smiled. True.
Grim nodded to Creedy, who sent several men to take charge of recovering the wagons from the Mist Shark's launch. They bustled the wagons away toward the Etherealist's cabin without delay. Calliope watched them go.
That takes care of the preliminaries, I suppose, she said. What do you intend to do with my crew?
I mean to return them, and you, to Spire Albion for arrest and trial, Grim said. The Aurorans will be taken prisoners of war and treated accordingly. Calliope shook her head.
You mean to have my crew tried as civilians for committing an act of war? They'll never submit to that. No Albion court will give them a fair trial, and they know it. They'll call them pirates and hang them.
Possibly, Grim said. On the other hand, if you refuse to surrender, then by the Articles of War, I could blast your ship down to the surface here and now. Which alternative do you think they'd find more attractive? Calliope's face darkened, and she clenched her jaw a few times before answering.
My crew are soldiers, fighting as soldiers. They will be tried and judged as soldiers in a time of war.
Or what? Grim asked mildly. Calliope stared at him, her mouth working on words that never quite formed, her eyes all but glowing with the heat of her anger. Then she closed her eyes and muttered a savage curse beneath her breath. Or what? Grim asked again in exactly the same tone.
You've made your point, she said in a bitter tone. You've made your point, you bastard. I am in no position to make demands of you.
No, Captain Ransom, you certainly are not, Grim said. Calliope made a face as though she had just bitten into a piece of rotten vat meat.
I request that my crew be taken as prisoners of war and held as such, Captain Grim. Please.
Grim nodded slowly several times. I want you to know something. She frowned and peered at him. I know that you didn't have to use the firing pattern you did at the landing shipyard. He said, you could have targeted Predator first instead of last.
Yes, she said simply.
I also want you to know that I realize why you offered me that contract the last time you came aboard. You didn't want me to be present for what was going to happen. You wanted Predator out of harm's way. Her head moved in what may have been the barest fraction of a nod. Why? Grim asked. Calliope looked away. The question hung heavy in the silence. After a moment she said,
Once she was my home too.
Grim's stomach stabbed with a little ache of echoed pain he thought he'd left behind him. I remember, he said quietly. Captain Ransom, I hereby declare your crew, your passengers, and yourself, prisoners under the Articles of War. Mr. Creedy, make a note to that effect in the ship's log.
Aye, Captain,
Creedy said firmly. Calliope closed her eyes for a moment and then nodded once to him. Her lips began to shape words several times, but evidently she could not force herself to actually say them. Grim had his victory. There was no point in rubbing it in any further. Your thanks are not necessary, Captain Ransom. I will be sending engineers back with you to board the Mist Shark and disable your cannon, and you will sail with Predator back to Spire Albion. You will be under my guns the entire way. If you deviate from any order I give, no matter how slightly, I will open fire. Do you understand?
I'm not an idiot, Francis.
Grim fought against annoyance, but felt a muscle at the corner of his mouth twitch despite his best efforts. Calliope saw it too, and her smirk settled back into place upon her lips. I suppose not,
Grimm said.
All the same, Calliope. The past several days have been an almighty trial. Do not test me.
Contact!
Shouted one of the lookouts in Predator's dorsal mast.
Captain, contact!
Grimm's head snapped around toward the lookout.
Where?
Inbound vessel high. West by southwest, coming fast.
An airship coming from the west. But the fleet was operating exclusively east of their current position. Grimm's stomach clenched and he felt his knees go a little loose and unsteady. He turned, flipping down his telescopic again, and spotted the incoming airship at once, heading for them at breakneck speed. He studied her through the telescopic carefully and tried to ignore the way his heart had begun beating faster and his hands had begun shaking.
Calliope, he said quietly, you don't need to be here. Get in your launch and go. Now.
He heard her draw in a small, sharp breath of her own as she saw the approaching ship.
I don't suppose I could convince you to surrender.
Grimm gave her a look over his shoulder. Her smirk turned bitter.
No, of course not. Duty.
She shook her head and with a few easy strides was off the bridge and heading back to her launch.
Sound general quarters, if you please, Mr. Creedy. Come about. Extend the web around the clock and get us moving.
The XO boomed out the orders, and once again the ship's bell began to ring. Men scrambled for their posts, quickly re-cinching their safety harnesses. Aeronauts swarmed into the masts, playing out the expansive lengths of the ship's web and getting Predator underway. Grimm stood motionless on the bridge, watching the menacing shape of AAV Itasca growing larger with unnerving rapidity, and wondered whether it was already too late to escape.
Chapter 67 AMS Predator.
Gwen felt rather ridiculous while moving from the infirmary to the bridge. Procedure aboard a ship engaged in combat action was for every crewman to keep at least one, and preferably two, safety lines secured to contact points at all times. Fixing the heavy metal clips to the secure rings was not the effortless task that the crew of Predator made it look like. Fortunately, runner bars stretching along the length of the deck and some of the internal hallways made the task simpler, if not easy. But nonetheless, it took her several minutes to travel no more than 80 feet. She reached the bridge just as Commander Creedy began bellowing orders to the ship's crew, and the deck tilted slightly beneath her feet as Predator began to bank into a turn. She was about to climb the steep staircase up to the bridge when the captain of the immobilized Mist Shark gripped the handrails and simply slid down them, landing effortlessly on the deck and nearly bowling Gwen over in the process. The tall woman gave her an impatient glance, took in the grease and grime on her clothes, and said,
"Good God in heaven! Is Journeyman allowing women into his engine room now? What is happening to the world?"
"Excuse me?" Gwen said.
"I suppose,"
the woman said, and moved at a gliding run down the deck, seemingly uncaring of the way the ship had begun to tilt and shudder, to where a launch had been tied up to Predator's flank. She vaulted the rail to the launch, nodding to the two rough-looking men crewing it, then began untying the mooring lines.
Gwen blinked at this behavior. Was the woman not effectively a captive? Was she escaping? Why on earth was no one putting a stop to it?
"Halt!"
Gwen said, in what she hoped was an authoritative tone. She began to lift her gauntlet to take aim at the escapee, then remembered, as she raised her arm, that she was not wearing her gauntlet, having spent most of the last day working with components of the ship's engines. Rather than abort the gesture entirely, which she felt would have looked weak and indecisive, she pointed a stern finger instead, and said,
"You there! Halt!"
The enemy captain looked up at her and burst out in a hearty belly laugh. Then she hauled against a lever that slowly kicked the launch out away from Predator. The launch began to fall behind Predator at once, since she wasn't being driven by any kind of etheric sail. Before the launch fell out of sight astern, the enemy captain called,
You've bigger problems than me now, girl.
And then the launch fell out of sight behind them. Gwen chewed on her lip for a second, then turned and laboriously ascended to the bridge. By the time she got there, Predator was fully underway, sailing swiftly into the morning sun, so that she had to squint against its brilliance as she secured her safety lines.